for advisement. We move to the third case this morning, Gomez versus Wagner Barnett versus and Gomez and Wagner Barnett versus St. Vincent Hospital Health Care.
Good morning, Your Honors. Attorney Ron Weldy of Welding Associates on behalf of Mrs. Gomez and Mrs. Wagner Barnett. Mrs. Gomez and Mrs. Wagner Barnett brought this action against St. Vincent because of the fact that they had received their COBRA notices late. In fact, they had received their COBRA notices after the 18-month period in which they were eligible for the COBRA benefits. That's not just a little late, that's extremely late. They brought this as a class.
Healthcare, or St. Vincent's, volunteer to provide coverage nonetheless?
Yes, Your Honor. With the astute help of their counsel, St. Vincent took many remedial actions in this case to attempt to deal with the fact that they had a system-wide failure that resulted in 16.9% of all of their qualified beneficiaries or employees who had had qualifying events not receiving their COBRA notices in a timely fashion. That in essence comes out to approximately one out of every six employees during a roughly year and a half period, and I can give you specifics, May 21st, 2004.
They were acquiring a lot of hospitals in this period, isn't that true?
Your Honor, in the facts, we list all the different hospitals they had. I think they had, as of January 1, 2004, which is when St. Vincent became the plan administrator for the relevant health, dental, and vision plans, I believe they had approximately 20 hospitals already. I think during the remainder of that time, they may have acquired another couple of hospitals. But they were already pretty large.
They had various subcontractors enforcing this requirements. Is that right?
They had multiple third-party administrators, TPAs, who they had contracted with in order to send out these COBRA notices. That's extremely relevant. If this court looks at the decision of the
That was partly because they were acquiring hospitals, wasn't it? Every hospital they acquired a different third-party enforcer, wasn't it?
I wasn't underneath that impression, Your Honor, no. I wasn't under the impression that they were acquiring hospitals and they had multiple TPAs because of those different hospitals that they were incorporating into their system. They had multiple TPAs because that was the decision of St. Vincent to go from ADP to Ceridian during the course of the time period we're discussing. That was my understanding, Your Honor. Your Honor, the fact that they had multiple TPAs is an extremely important aspect, because this court is one of the issues this court needs to address is, does a plan administrator have a duty to have a oversight system in place to ensure that TPAs do their job?
I guess I'm confused about that. I don't know what you mean by an oversight system other than the administrator has to do the job. They have to make sure the notices get sent, right?
In essence, Your Honor, I mean, I can quote you what the...
Are you saying that as a matter of law, there has to be this institution called oversight or whatever you want to call it that has the responsibility to check on the TPAs?
I believe that's what the 11th Circuit held in the Scott versus Suncoast Beverage case back in 2002. They held that there were three things that the administrator should do if they're going to be utilizing the TPA. One is ensure that the necessary information was provided to the third party to send a notice. Two, ensure that the third party was asked to send the notice. And three, take steps taken to ensure that the notice was actually sent out by the third party.
So that's to do the job that COBRA requires. I don't know why there would have to be a separate oversight body involved, why there has to be that additional layer as a matter of law. While it might make some sense to have someone checking on it, I don't know how you get to that it's required as a matter of law.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that when COBRA was instituted in the mid-80s that at that point in time, Congress was thinking, you know, are we going to actually have plan administrators doing this physically themselves, meaning an employer in this case, doing this, or that there's going to be something like a TPA that comes into existence that will often handle these things on behalf of large corporations. I agree with Your Honor completely that the mandatory nature of COBRA when you read the COBRA statute, there's nothing that seems discretionary about it. Everything is you must do this, you must do this. The deadlines are very much so mandatory, not discretionary. I think when you start talking about TPAs, that's when you say, well, if you want to hand this off, because the duty still lies with you, plan administrator, you're going to need to have some sort of oversight system in place or you're not complying with the mandatory nature of the statute itself. And so, you know, we may be talking semantics here, Your Honor, but I think that's what the 11th Circuit held back in 2002, and I think that's one of the issues that's been presented to this court today is, you know, does this circuit agree that if a plan administrator is going to utilize a TPA, that they have to have a system in place to ensure that that TPA is doing the job that's dictated by the statute? And, Your Honor, that has huge public policy implications. If there is no mandatory oversight system that has to be put in place, then following the ruling of the district court, where, you know, we don't have a penalty, any statutory penalty associated here whatsoever, then plan administrators can sit back and say, well, what do we have to worry about? If the TPA doesn't do their job, we're not going to get punished. It's not like we're not going to face any financial liability in the form of a statutory penalty, because district courts in at least the Seventh Circuit are going to rely upon the decision of Judge Charker in this case to say, hey, you know, the TPAs are the ones that messed up. We're not going to hold the plan administrator responsible for that. So the notion that there needs to be some sort of mandated oversight system has to do with what kind of responsibility plan administrators are going to take going forward after this court issues an opinion in this case, respecting their duties underneath the COBRA statute, quite frankly. So I think it's got huge public policy implications, stating whether or not this court believes there is a need for a mandated oversight system or not.
Now, you say mandated. Again, you're saying it's a matter of law?
I am, Your Honor. I think
so. Where in COBRA do you get that, other than the requirement that COBRA's terms be complied with?
Your Honor, I'm saying that the COBRA terms say they have to be complied with, and if the administrator isn't going to do it themselves, then the next progression of that would be mandated system to ensure that the TPAs they hire do it.
Mandated by the court.
By the court.
Not by the statute.
It is a reasonable interpretation of the statute based upon the fact that there is now a third party doing it to ensure that the duties articulated by the statute are being followed by that third party. Once again, Your Honor, this is not my idea. I am taking this completely from the 11th Circuit in the Scott versus Suncoast Beverage case. So I'm not going to take authorship of this. I think the 11th Circuit did a great job in analyzing this decision already, and I'm simply following what my interpretation of their case was and simply asking this court to follow that interpretation. Your Honor, this case was brought as a class action because of the fact that we identified 266 employees who had qualifying events in this case. And one of the issues is whether or not class certification should have been granted in this case or not. The first issue I'd like to point out is that the district court assumed facts not in the record. And these were vital facts. I'm sorry, Your Honor, it looked like you had a question.
Well, I think what you're alluding to is that Judge Barker referred to findings that I think Judge Hamilton had made in another case.
Flip it. Judge Hamilton referred to Judge Barker's case,
well,
yes.
Well, can't a judge do that, look to the docket of another court and see what has been ruled on and what the rulings were?
Well, what I was talking about here...
You submitted Judge McKinney's selection of you as class counsel in another case. Isn't this the equivalent of that?
What I was talking about specifically in this instance, Your Honor, and I think what I said was general enough that you could take it two ways. Let me get to the one I was talking about. What I was discussing was the fact that Judge Hamilton assumed, without any evidence in the record, that both Mrs. Gomez and Mrs. Wagner-Barnett did not have any actual damages, i.e. that they were not entitled to any equitable damages. There were no facts in the record at that point in time. Administrator had not made any sort of factual showing. It was not discussed by either party. And yet, Judge Hamilton referred on numerous occasions throughout his opinion, citing that the facts were identical to Judge Barker's decision and Brown-Pfeiffer, which in that case, very specifically, there was evidence in the record that, in fact, Ms. Brown-Pfeiffer had not had any actual damages, and Ms. Woods had a very, very small amount of prescription damages, almost a de minimis amount. So that's
this,
the first
This wasn't
error.
Your first case before Judge Hamilton, was it? He had had some experience with you on other cases, hadn't he?
In class action cases, Your Honor?
All kinds of cases.
Yes, yes. I'd had multiple cases with Judge Hamilton. Yes, Your Honor. So, but my point is that one of the reasons why we feel that the class certification ruling was incorrect is because Judge Hamilton made a factual assumption that was, in fact, incorrect. I mean, Ms. Wagner-Barnett obviously did have actual damages. Either that or Judge Barker would not have found equitable damages in this case. Sure, we disagree as to the amount of those equitable damages, and that's a small issue in this case. But his decision on class certification was based upon, in large part, upon the fact that he said it was identical in all factual respects with Judge Barker's decision in Brown-Pfeiffer. That
yeah,
is absolutely incorrect.
Findings, you know, he didn't rely entirely on to what Judge Barker had decided.
I don't know about that, Your Honor, to be honest with you. One of the other issues that came up in the class certification was the question of whether or not I was adequate counsel for the proposed class.
That was the basis for not certifying, right?
Your Honor, it's both. I mean, I can read to you each and every sentence that Judge Hamilton cited saying that the case
well,
was identical.
On that.
That's fine, Your Honor. Your Honor, Judge Hamilton stated that based upon actions that were alluded to in Judge Barker's decision in Brown-Pfeiffer, that he was going to hold that I was not adequate counsel to represent this class in his case. Now, specifically, he said that the filing of the second action was using up scarce resources. Well, that was based upon the assumption that the two cases were, in fact, identical, factually identical, which, of course, they were not. That was a misassumption. Secondly,
well, the only difference is this rather minor damages.
Yes, Your Honor, but Judge Barker herself in the Brown-Pfeiffer said that that was a critical factor in her decision not to certify the class. So if it was a critical factor, it obviously was a big deal. Your Honor, I'll leave the rest of the rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Good morning. My name is Craig Williams. I represent St. Vincent Health in this matter. May it please the Court. I think, as alluded to in counsel's argument, a little background is necessary to understand the rulings in this case that are currently before the Court. Originally, this action involving this particular proposed class was filed in 2006. That case, the motion for class certification was denied. Really for three reasons, a lack of typicality of the claims by the named representatives, inadequacy of the class representatives, and inadequacy of class counsel. Ultimately, in that case, the district court granted summary judgment in favor of St. Vincent and declined to use its discretion to award statutory penalties to the two named plaintiffs in that case. The named plaintiffs, who were represented by counsel in this matter, appealed to this court. Ultimately, they abandoned that appeal. Using the discovery that counsel received in the prior matter, they directly solicited new plaintiffs to file a new action, and that's indeed what they did, a new action involving the exactly same class with exactly the same facts. Now, I know counsel says that the facts are a little different with respect to the damages. I will get to that. But ultimately, or initially, St. Vincent challenged the class allegations with a motion to dismiss, arguing that the American pipe tolling would allow the individual claims to move forward, that tolling didn't ultimately apply to class claims. Now, the district court denied St. Vincent's motion to dismiss, instead choosing to follow the minority view of the Third Circuit in McCowan, Lowell and Company and Yang and v. Odom. However, in doing so, the court specifically noted that problems with class counsel can be dealt with more precisely, which is exactly what the court did later in deciding to decline class certification in this case based on inadequacy of class counsel. Now, I would submit that the sole reason that the court denied the motion for class certification in the instant action was due to inadequacy of counsel. I realize that Judge Hamilton sided with favor Judge Barker's previous case, but he made very clear that he was denying the class motion based on inadequacy of counsel because he felt that counsel had shown a lack of respect for the judicial resources by essentially, in his term, seeking an appellate review of Judge Barker's decision with him by refiling the case with the exact same facts. Now, counsel has indicated that, well, the facts are different because ultimately Ms. Wagner-Barnett was found to have incurred $396 of damages. But the timing with respect to that came later. At the time Judge Hamilton ruled on the motion for class certification, he had before him arguments and facts which were substantially, I won't say identical, but substantially the same as the facts and arguments that were before Judge Barker. They were not different. Only later did the court decide that, or that the court decided that facts were sufficient to award a damage of $396 to Ms. Wagner-Barnett. None of that was on the table at the time that the motion for class certification was ruled upon. And it is the burden is on the plaintiffs to establish all the elements of Rule 23, including adequacy of counsel. And that's really the issue that's on the court here, is Judge Hamilton's denial of class certification based on inadequacy of counsel due to what he viewed as a lack of respect for the scarce judicial resources. Now, additionally, he did refer to dilatory discovery responses both in the instant action and both in the prior action. In both cases, St. Vincent was required to file a motion to compel. In both cases, the motion to compel was granted. In both cases, fees were awarded. And so that he did view that as an ongoing dilatory response to St. Vincent's legitimate discovery responses. Moving toward the discretionary statutory award, it is somewhat confusing to me, counsel's argument regarding what the Scott case suggests. As I read the Scott case, it suggests that a plan administrator cannot point to a third-party administrator to escape liability. St. Vincent has never made that argument in this case. We concede that the plaintiffs in this case did not receive COBRA notice in a timely manner, but yet we argue that the court should exercise its discretion and decline to award a statutory penalty. And that's indeed, the discretion is right there in the statute. 502C says that the court, in its discretion, may decide to impose a penalty of up to $110 a day. The court in this matter determined that there was no gross negligence, no undue prejudice, no bad faith, and those are all factors that courts have looked upon to decide whether a statutory penalty is necessary. Now, I concede that a finding of prejudice is not required to impose a statutory penalty, but certainly courts look to those factors in order to make that determination. Here the court viewed, and Judge, I wanted to know, I don't think it was a matter of obtaining new hospitals. It was a matter of consolidating the way that those various hospitals within the organization tendered its COBRA notices to its employees. And so it was a process of consolidation of those various plans rather than obtaining new hospitals along the way. And so I think that the court did not abuse its discretion in declining to award statutory penalties in this matter, and the court did not abuse its discretion in declining to grant class certification.
Did the plan agree to pay or provide coverage for the period of time which they didn't have coverage because of the deficient notice?
Yeah, notice went out to every individual who the plan had identified as receiving late notice. A new notice went out giving each individual the option of, essentially of hindsight. They were allowed to retroactively choose coverage for that 18-month period, or they could choose prospective coverage going forward. St. Vincent was in a position to do that because they're self-insured. I know if they were covered by other insurance plans, that may not have been an option, but certainly was in this case. So, we did not require a lump sum payment of all 18 months of COBRA premiums. We indicated in that notice that if someone would have financial difficulty doing that, they could certainly call us and set up a payment plan. This isn't part of the record, but one person took the bait, and then that was resolved, to my knowledge, and they were covered retroactively.
How did the damages arise in for one of these plaintiffs?
Well, during Ms. Wagner-Barnett's deposition, she testified that she was out of medical insurance for roughly a two-month period, and that she recalled having to pay a pretty sizable prescription of $700 one time. Now, there was some other testimony regarding some vision benefits or putting some money down for glasses, but that was unclear in her deposition testimony. At one point in time, I think she said, yes, I was not covered during that time. And another point in time, she said, I don't know whether I was covered or not. So based upon that inconsistent testimony, the district court said, well, that's speculation at best. And so,
I understand the glasses, but she did award.
What the court did, Your Honor, is take the $700 prescription that the plaintiff said she paid and subtracted what the amount she would have had to pay in a COBRA premium to arrive at $396. That's how the district court got there. And it's somewhat curious now that the plaintiffs are alleging that while at the district court they argued that Ms. Wagner-Barnett was entitled to $636 in total, yet now in front of this court they argue that she's entitled to $940. Not sure of the discrepancy there, but I would argue that request has been waived at this point in time. And accordingly, we request that this court affirm the district court's decisions in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Weldy, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Weldy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just once again, the actual damages of Mrs. Gomez and Ms. Wagner-Barnett were not briefed by either party with regard to the motion for class certification. It's not, looking at the merits of the case is actually something that the U.S. Supreme Court has said a long time ago. A judge is not supposed to do during the course of deciding a motion for class certification, and I've cited to that case in both of my briefs, okay? So it simply wasn't there. There was no reason for us to put it there. Even though we knew what the answer was, it wasn't a factor. Judge Hamilton made it a factor in that case. And that's why he said that the cases were, that this case was identical in every nature to the Brown Fiber case. A holding that is factually inaccurate. Your Honor, it's my understanding through courts, both district courts and circuit courts throughout the country, and I've cited to at least 7 or 8 different cases throughout my brief, that the focus of the statutory penalty is on the administrator's conduct, not the impact on the participant. A statutory penalty is meant to be in the nature of a punitive damages designed to punish the violator and punish noncompliance with the act.
So that would take some sort of bad faith, some and bad faith that you would have to have shown
No, Your Honor, bad faith is...
Isn't that what punitive damages is about, a malicious attitude or a state of mind that requires a penal result?
Your Honor, I don't have a malicious state of mind when I violate the posted speed limit, and yet I get a ticket. The COBRA statute is mandatory in nature.
But the penalty is discretionary, and cases seem to look at it as a punitive matter, as something like a punitive damage or penal in nature.
Your Honor, as a matter of public policy, if a statutory penalty is not imposed on St. Vincent when they have a system-wide failure of this nature, every single defendant across the country is going to think they can get away with a COBRA violation. It's not going to cost them a dime. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.